MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. I asked Michigan State University President Luana Simon what Spartans need to know about the state of the FRIB project, that's the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams, in light of Energy Secretary Chu's remarks last week at the Detroit Economic Club.
Well, I think there's reason to worry with the number of budget reduction scenarios that are floating around in Washington. And there's reason to worry because a number of those do not protect big science, which I think, apart from having a self-interest, is a mistake for U.S. competitiveness. If you simply look at the number of patents that are being produced abroad, you look at the technological advances upon which we've come to rely in a modern day, many of those are now done abroad. So you don't want to concede leadership in fundamental science because out of fundamental science comes those discoveries. So we now need to worry, I think, as a nation about that. And so the funding for things like FRIB are wrapped up in the priorities about how people view big science against other programs. So we have been working with the FRIB Advisory Committee. We've had people contacting the White House well before Secretary Chu's statement. There was a Science Magazine article in November which raised concerns about a big project, EITER, that is a multinational project that's growing and growing in budget size, and how if the department continues that commitment to EITER, that it will then require defunding some major projects, or we would be among that list. On the other hand, I wasn't surprised that Secretary Chu didn't say, gee whiz, we're going to fund FRIB. Yes, we are. And his response in the public session was much more measured, as you would expect of an administrator. I understand that his comments to the press gave a stronger impression that FRIB wasn't one of the priorities. You know, we are always going to worry about the bias of the agency towards national laboratories. After all, if you go back to the beginning of the process, they were going to give this project to Argonne without bidding it or competing it. So that it's inherent in a big bureaucracy. I don't think necessarily it's the bias of Secretary Chu or his leadership, but you've got a huge bureaucracy making budgetary analysis. So we've been very vigilant and been working this issue. What we have to do is perform very well on the review in April, and we're prepared to do that. And continue to work the political process.
Also in the news, as President Simon and her colleagues were gathering at the NCAA meetings last week, is the fact that college football's movers and shakers are beginning to meet to at least talk about a college football playoff.
The BCS groups meet regularly and continue to evaluate the landscape for our individual bowls that have been part of the tradition of our conferences for a very long time. And it's important to remind people that the bowl system was not a national bowl system. It was a bowl system that was really the proprietary commitments of particular conferences. It's only relatively recently that the idea was to use those as a platform for those broader than those narrow conference objectives. So I think that the times have changed, and the commissioners and the presidents are going to be discussing this over the next year or so. Most of the bowl contracts that are individual contracts are up in a couple of years. So I think there's time to think about what would happen and what should happen in that regard. No matter how many institutions you pick, there's always going to be a controversy about who was left out. So the idea in some of the press that somehow we could reduce the controversy, I'm not particularly sure about that. And if a model, as some have proposed, emerged that you got to play at home, the advantages of a home team are enormous. And so you'll have controversy about that. So the idea that somehow there's a panacea here, I think, is a really flawed one. It's just a matter of what people want to sort of spend a lot of time talking about. I think it is important to worry about the number of games people play. It is important to worry about missed class time for spring semester because that these are students, and they've had a very rugged fall semester. And it's important for the institution, for the team, for the individuals to make sure that they have a very good spring semester. Some of the plans I've seen treat student athletes as if they had no other responsibilities other than to play football. And so all of that has to sort of get worked out, not simply, you know, gee whiz, let's deal with a true national champion.
President Simon also details MSU's just-announced energy transition plan.
Well, I think that what the group has done is recognize that over the ultimate goal would be to move to 100% renewables. But that's not feasible in a short-term strategy. And that in order to make a plan viable, one has to give space for emerging technologies, some that we don't know about today. We have to make sure that we keep the cost to students reasonable because energy plays a big part of our budget. And so you can't simply blithely go spend money on approaches that are much more costly and ineffective or inefficient just to make a political statement. So the report does indicate that while the ultimate goal is all renewables, there is a short-term place for coal, which will upset some people. It also has a strategy about how to use savings from energy conservation to pay for the kinds of things that we need without putting a burden on students and their families. So it has a lot of very complicated elements. It's not a political statement. It is an approach that has metrics that can be assessed annually, and it's an approach that can be modified as new information emerges. So it's going to be interesting to see how the community deals with it because it is one of those practical MSU plans that has very lofty goals and very, in many ways, aggressive short-term goals, but at the same time is honest about ways in which we need to solve them and honest about the cost it would take to have various alternatives be an active part of the plan. So the framework is there, and what we're going to see is what the community thinks about that, what their balances are, because there's a way of adjusting the plan so that you can have a little bit more of this, a little bit less of that, and understand the cost of your actions.
So you'll want feedback when you present it in April?
We've given it to the board. The community has it. We're seeking the community's feedback. What this isn't is, again, an ideological statement. It is a very strategic and practical way of trying to look at energy use and all the factors that go with our carbon footprint. So if you want to stand up and say, gee whiz, we'll do no more X by this date, it says in order to do that, this is what you have to do. Are you prepared to do that? Okay. Or is it practical to do that in a campus this large? We're still going to reduce aggressively our carbon footprint. We're still going to reduce or eliminate our use of coal, but it's not just, you know, saying, gee whiz, as some campuses have, you know, by X date we're going to get rid of coal, or X date we're going to do this, when the person who's making the statement probably won't be there. It's really a political statement. It's not based on a plan about how to do it. And this is sort of based on a plan of how to do that, but very consistent with the philosophies of MSU State being a part of the leadership in green-related issues. It also relies on continued research here and with our partners around the world and with using the ideas of students to think about better ways of doing things, particularly energy conservation space.
As 2012 dawns, President Simon assesses the state of Michigan State.
Well, we've come, you know, if you think about the last 10 years and the support of public higher education, you know, and the fact that Michigan's near the bottom, you look at the concerns that I think are being expressed nationally about the cost to the nation of disinvesting, particularly in major research universities and global competitiveness. Michigan State has come through a very, very difficult economic time with momentum. We have much yet to do. There are always things we can do better, but we're sustaining a momentum through probably the most difficult, sustained financial time in our history. and we're able to attract and retain really great people. So you have to feel good about where we're at.
Please visit President Simon online at president.msu.edu. And for MSU Today on SpartanPodcast.com, I'm Russ White.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Our next guest has a day job as a communications manager for the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. But several years ago, she decided to turn a passion for growing things and for sipping wine into an avocation. And now she's a full-fledged viticulturalist. Her name is Robin Usborne, and we welcome her to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Robin, I know this has been a long journey and it's been a dream fulfilled, but how did you decide, why did you decide to get into the grape growing business?
Well, as you say, I have been involved in agriculture, natural resources since college. I grew up on a farm. My dad was a farmer. A lot of my relatives are farmers. But when I got into the communications business, I enjoyed working with these folks, and especially with the horticulture folks, it became, I'm listening to them and how they did things. And especially I became acquainted with Stan Howell, who had
the grape guru of Michigan, basically.
Yes, he really helped start the wine and grape industry in Michigan going back in the 70s. And they had a program, the viticulture and enology, like a certificate program that looked very interesting to me. And I said to him, I'm thinking about taking these classes. And he said, Robin, we'd be glad to have you anytime you want to come. So I started taking the classes, and fortunately here at Michigan State, we're able to take classes, and they encourage that. So as I was taking those classes, I realized that this was not only an industry, but a family of folks that had really gotten into something that was new and exciting in a different industry. So I took the classes, became pretty well acquainted with a lot of the people in the industry in Michigan and through the program, and decided to start my own vineyard.
And we've known each other for a long time, and I remember you taking those classes, and those were rigorous classes. For our listeners who may not know the difference, you threw out a couple of terms, and I've used it too, viticulture and enology. What's the difference between viticulture and enology?
Viticulture is a grape growing. Enology is more toward the winemaking. So that's kind of the difference. I know the words sound big, but it's grape growing and winemaking.
So you bought some property, and take us through the story. And it took you several years to grow these grapes, but now you're the story is a great story.
Oh. Well, my sister and I had been vacationing. We had a sister's vacation up in Benzie County near Crystal Lake for many years. And as most folks know, there's a large contingent of grape growing and winemaking in northwest Michigan, mainly in Leelanau County and in Grand Traverse County. Benzie County is just a little bit south of those and right next to them. I thought, there's got to be places here to grow grapes. So fortunately, being connected with the university as I am, it was nice to talk to Jim Nugent, who at that time was the director of the Northwest Michigan Station, horticulture station, talking about now he must know areas in Benzie County because he actually lived there. And he tuned me into a few people to talk to, Andy Norman, and some other folks who actually had been working with not only with other people looking for property to grow orchards and grapes, but also with the Grant and Travers Land Conservancy had some property for sale. So as you can imagine, not only did I have to find a place that would be good for growing grapes, it would have to be affordable, and it would have to be someplace that I could easily start doing this business. There's a lot of property that's available, but a lot of it already has orchard planted on it. So I was able to talk to a realtor whose dad actually had some acreage that was for sale. And she gave me numerous pieces of property and parcels to look at. And I kept coming back to her dad's parcel. He was 92 years old at the time. And I decided I would talk to him about the property, asking, you know, things about the soil, about the climate. And he sat down with me, and like a typical, you know, farmer, he acted a little bit reticent. What do you want to do with it? Well, it's never done this. Well, yeah, I guess you could try that. And then so I said, you know, I'm really, really interested. I said, how firm is the price that you want for it? And he didn't say anything. He looked at me and he goes, well, I'll drop it for you. And he dropped the price significantly. And it turns out his daughter said to me later, he really is interested in this. He's really excited for this property to be used this way.
Because, you sold him about how serious you were about
this
thing.
And he did not want it to go into some type of strip mall or other kind of business that would take away from the natural integrity of the property and of the land around it.
So how many acres did you buy, and how long did it take you to get these grapes going?
A little over 8 acres. I planted 5 acres of grapes. The first year, all I did was have it excavated and planted to a cover crop. And then the next year, had it tilled up, and then we planted it. So to get it planted took about 2 years. To get the grapes to a point where they actually produce a crop is 3. So then they only grow like a half a crop at that time. So this year is the 4th year I've had the grapes in, and we got pretty much close to a full crop this year.
What happens to your grapes? Who's buying your grapes, and what kind of wines are they going into?
Well, one of the things we learned during our classes, this is a business. This is not only something that people do, but you know, this is a pretty serious business. And part of the business plan that we had to create was one of the first things they ask you is, who's going to buy those grapes? Before you plant them, you should have an idea, or at least know who will buy your grapes. Fortunately, there were folks in my classes who were parents, or either their parents or they were already in the winemaking business. So I called one of the students whose dad, he worked for his dad as a winemaker at Mackinac Trail Winery, which is in Manistique, Michigan.
And I asked Mackinac him, Trail Winery.
Right. Manistique, that is, and they also have tasting rooms in Petoskey and Mackinac City. And I said, hey, Dustin, I said, I'm thinking about putting in some grapes. I said, do you think your dad would buy them if I put some grapes in? And he says, I think he will. Let me call him. And I thought, well, I'll hear from him in a couple of days. 30 minutes later, he calls and he says, my dad will buy every grape you grow. And he says he's always looking for more Michigan grapes and Michigan fruit. So there's quite a need for it as far as more grapes in Michigan that are Michigan-grown grapes for wine. So that was not a problem.
So you had a market for your grapes before you even started growing them.
Right.
That's not a bad business plan at all.
Well, yeah. Everyone says to me they think that was a good idea.
Well, Robin, this point, your story, which is so cool, points to the whole growth of the Michigan wine industry, and the small vineyards and wineries continue to emerge, and it's been quite a success story, hasn't it?
Yes. Right now, according to the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council folks, we have 89 wineries. Eight of those have started in the past year. And of those eight, there are six that have popped up now in Northwest Michigan. So we also have quite a few in Southwest Michigan. And we also have a couple now in the UP. So that's a little different. That, you know, you wouldn't think that that would be a place where there'd be a lot of wine or grapes growing and wine being made, but it's getting bigger. So.
Yeah, and the growing importance to the Michigan's economy. We'd like to refer to agriculture in general on the show as the original green industry. And just to underscore that, the greenness of growing grapes, for example, I know that you, because I've known you for a long time, but other grape growers are very conscious of the environment when you're going about your management practices.
Right, that's true. And in both Old Mission Peninsula in Northwest Michigan and in Leelanau Peninsula, there are some ordinances that also guide what can be done and how it can be grown for some of those grape growers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them, there's even an organic, a totally certified organic winery in Leelanau Peninsula now. So there are folks that are looking at that. A lot of as grape growers, we fight a few battles as far as everything wants to eat our grapes more, you know, as much as we do. We, you know, there's insects, there's diseases, there's
birds,
animals,
yeah,
there's deer. You know, everyone wants it before we are. So we kind of fight this battle between, okay, you can have a few, but most of it's for us. But fortunately, for where my vineyard is located, I don't have too much of a pest problem as far as insects. I deal mostly with keeping the birds out and keeping the funguses and the mildews and the rots out. So fortunately, the IPM program that they have here at Michigan State.
Meaning Integrated Pest Management.
Right? Correct. Mm-hmm. And we kind of look at those folks as helping us decide when it is important as far as looking at, you know, if it's going to rain tomorrow, what the weather is, and what other, you know, circumstances are going on. That's how we decide if we need to spray or if we need to treat or what we need to do, rather than just go out there and just blanket do it all the time. So it's also helpful economically and for the environment. So.
Yeah, not only can you reduce costs of some of the chemical applications, but you're doing good things for the environment at the same time.
And one of the winery owners who also, you know, does a lot of grape growing, he basically uses as little as possible. And a lot of times he says, well, the reason I let the pests eat some of this stuff is because the way grapes grow, you know, they're doing me a favor. Why do I need to hire someone to prune it when I can have the bugs go out there and eat a few vines and eat a few leaves, and that'll keep it down for me. So that's, you know, it's a win-win. So
I'm talking with Robin Usborne, who is a grape grower. Her grapes are grown in Benzie County in northern Michigan. She's also a communications manager at Michigan State University and the College of Ag and Natural Resources. Okay, Robin, we've talked about growing the grapes. We've talked about you selling your grapes to the winery. A lot of people are familiar with those wonderful Michigan wines. What are some good recommendations from someone who really knows wines? I'm going to put you right on the spot here.
Well, I'll tell you, Thanksgiving is, you'd think about turkey and those kind of things, something a little lighter meats and that kind of thing. Things like dry Rieslings are good. The Pinot Noir here in Michigan is great for that. Gewürztraminer is also, the Gewürztraminers, the Rieslings, and the Pinot Noir that we grow here are a little more crisp, a little more acidic. They go very nicely with that. Of course, we can't forget some of the ice wines and the late harvest wines that are sweeter, but they go very well with desserts and all by themselves. Maybe if you think you're doing a little lighter, you want to have like a cookie and some late harvest wines. Those are very nice accompaniments, and with cheesecake as well, that kind of thing. If you're getting more into the meats, with the Cabernet Franc is good. There's a lot of good blends as well. I mean, some people, blending is of wine is really become more and more of an art form, and it's also really beneficial that for folks who don't really know exactly what they want to drink or aren't really sure, you know, go into any tasting room, you know, they'll be happy to show you and let you taste some wines when you're really not sure, because some of these grape varieties put together complement each other so well.
And the tasting rooms at the Michigan wineries, I mean, each one is a different experience. I mean, it's not only do you get to taste the wines and that sort of thing, but you're also getting an ag tourism experience at the same time.
What's nice about the smaller wineries in Michigan is they are so much a reflection of the person who owns them and manages them. And you learn a lot about how they do it right from the ground up. A lot of them will let you come in and have tours of their winery themselves, just real quick, you know, go through and show you the tanks and what they go through. And they're very passionate about what they're doing. And I think that's the great experience about being in Michigan and in this industry is the smaller wineries, the more personalized experience that you get. And you can see it from the time where they grow the grapes to when they put it in the tanks and right to the bottle. So.
You mentioned something a moment ago, which was ice wine, and we've got about a minute left, but a lot of people don't know what ice wine is. Can you quickly explain to our listeners, what is that?
Ice wine are grapes, are made from grapes that are left on the vine, and they are frozen until they're frozen. So it's getting pretty close now. They squeeze those grapes, and that juice that comes from those grapes, of course, is very, very thick, and it's really full-bodied, very sweet. It's concentrated, and it's hard to get a lot of grapes. That's why it's so expensive. It's hard to one of those grapes that kind of varieties that it's hard to vinify. But once they do, it's a great experience.
My guest has been Robin Usborn. She's a communications manager at Michigan State University. She also grows grapes on her property up in Benzie County. Robin, congratulations on a dream fulfilled. I know. I mean, you must really. Feel really, really accomplished now that you're actually seeing your grapes come to fruition.
But it's also, okay, what's going to happen next year?
You sound like a real farmer, Robin.
Yeah, it's gotten to that point, yeah.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great to talk about this.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family, and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
Here's Michigan State University President Luanna Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU Women's Basketball Coach Susie Merchant.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have with us MSU Women's Basketball Coach Susie Merchant. Big Ten championship, great year, but most important from my perspective, and I know from Mark's, a terrific person and someone we're so proud to have as a part of Team MSU. Small town kid, big dreams. And it was as you think about this sort of whirlwind as you've come to Michigan State, what stands out most in your mind?
I think the passion of the people and the unity here. I think anyone that steps foot on this campus can feel it, and it's energizing. And it, you know, for me, it definitely inspires you to do great things. You know, you want to make the people in the stands proud. You want to make your administration proud for giving you the opportunity. So, for me, those are the things that stand out the most.
What are some of you grew up here? I think anytime that an athletic director is looking for a coach, they're looking for fit. with you. You grew up here. You went. You played college in the state. You kind of recruited in the state, and then you come to Michigan State, which I think we both kind of think is the pinnacle of our professions. But if you look back over time and you look at coaching Saginaw Valley, Eastern, Michigan State, what are some of the changes that you've seen in kids that you're recruiting today, how you have to go about it differently, and how would you relate that to maybe the business life? This will take the next hour.
I was just going to say, how long is the show? You know, I just think that the trends have just kind of forced some things that maybe isn't always good for the game. I think the entourage of people has changed. You know, and when I first got into it, I felt like, you know, the parental involvement was there in a healthy way. That's going to sound terrible sometimes, but, you know, sometimes there are some hovering parents a little bit, the helicopter parents. But, you know, I feel like now it's gotten away from the family decisions, and it's gotten involved in a lot more people from an entourage perspective. So knowing who those key people are is really important. You know, I think that's sometimes a full-time job in and of itself when you're recruiting high-level players, especially. You know, and then for me growing up here, I also think, you know, some of the challenges are is, you know, I think as good as the resources have gotten, so is everybody else's and the arms race. You can't just talk about facilities anymore. So for us, you know, when we look at, you know, looking at Michigan State with recruits, we always talk about the synergy, the fit, the feeling you get when you come on campus. This is family. This is home. This is where you belong. And we can cite so many examples. And I can remember when when I got the job and Tom and I were talking, Coach Izzo, he had said to me, you know, this is Division II people in a big-time BCS school. And I kind of came up that way, so I get it. But it's the small-town people that make this place special.
Is there, when you're recruiting, is there one thing that student-athletes or prospective student-athletes focus on? Is there one, you know, you've got services, you've got facilities, you've got people, and you've got success. Is there one thing that really stands out that all of them come in and want to take a good crack at?
Well, I think, you know, you have to have the facility piece because everybody does, but that's not really why kids come here. I think, you know, every player we've recruited, it's been something different. You know, some of them are very academic driven. Some of them, you know, they're a little nervous maybe about the size of the school. Others love the passion and the size of the school. So for us, it's really about figuring out as a coach, probably every coach on this campus figures out what is the most important thing to that recruit and how do you tailor it to fit them and sell them Michigan State, which I think is an easy sell.
And when you walk outside the boundaries of the athletic department, because we are part of a larger organization, which is the university, where do you turn and what kind of assistance, guidance, resources do you get on campus from other folks?
I mean, everywhere. I mean, everywhere you turn. I don't think there's a place that I couldn't pick up the phone to call if there was an interest from a recruit or, you know, a part of campus that we didn't know enough about. I really feel like, you know, here, it's home, it's family. It's we're all in this together. Team MSU, as Dr. Simon talks about. You know, and I really feel like, you know, her and Roy are a great resource, too, because, you know, there's not many presidents that come to women's basketball games, and she loves it, and her and Roy love it, and they're passionate about it. And I think, you know, people need to know that because it's an important part of, obviously, of the campus life, athletics, but just to know that women's basketball is right there with Dr. Simon and obviously you, Mark, as well, and your support, it means a great deal to us.
When I think about women's basketball in a day, being much older than you, where it was a big revolution to cross the center line, you know, and all the rule changes.
Three on three.
But, yeah. All the rule changes that I've watched.
I don't remember those days.
You're too young. Women's basketball, and now you know, pro leagues, international play, AAU is taking on a bigger a component of women's basketball as it has in men's basketball over the years. How much of that, in a sense, do you relish the change, and how much is a little part of you that worries about the trends of women's basketball?
Yeah, you know, to me, I think growing up, I've always, my thing was I've always wanted to be somewhere where it mattered, you know, where you, when you were the coach on the sidelines and your team ran out, there was people in the stands and there was atmosphere. And so that is the growth of the game has really, I think, taken off exponentially. Even in the last, you know, five, seven years, I really feel like, you know, the trend has changed. But so that part is good. I'd love to keep that. I think, you know, the other piece, I think the days of the self-made player, you lose those a little bit. I think, you know, kids play so many AAU games now that there's a couple things that are challenged. You know, I think the competitive edge sometimes is there. But when you go up through AAU, you know, they play at noon, they turn around and play at 2, and it doesn't matter if they win or lose because they're getting their game at 4. So creating that culture of a true winning sense, sometimes you have to find the X factor in kids. And I think that's something that the AAU ball has maybe kind of dissolved itself a little bit and kind of, you know, started to erode a little bit of that spirit in kids. But, you know, to me, I think those are the things that stand out the most when I think of, you know, where the game has gone. But I love our accessibility. I think that's the one thing our sport is. We're extremely accessible to people. I think, you know, our niche of our market, the young families and some of the retirees, I mean, those are people that you just get them to meet the coaching staff or, you know, a player, they run into them in the grocery store. They're a fan for life and they're pretty passionate fans. So that kind of grassroots feeling, I really appreciate and love.
You have two small boys. But when I go to women's basketball, there are families with boys, girls, all ages. Clearly, it's a great sense of what young girls can do to be successful. But how do you see the sport affecting families with both boys and girls as you think about the role that you play?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think it certainly puts women in a different light at such an early age. You know, I did a seminar, or I was a keynote speaker for Women in Construction not too long ago, and Alton Granger, the head of Granger Construction, actually did the welcome, and he had talked about it wasn't that long ago, but 30 years ago, the first woman they ever hired was a secretary receptionist, and now how times have changed. And I look at my little boys, and you know, they're cheering the loudest at their mom's games for young women, and I think that's such a great example that you know, the gender bias isn't there, that you know, they're understanding that lines cross, and maybe that's why women's basketball is so appealing.
When I was at the softball game with Michigan just a little while back, Hutch took her team over to a championship plaque and talked about what it took with her team back in the day to really cross that barrier, to really make a difference. And a couple of the girls weren't really listening, and she got their attention very quickly to talk about they're here because of the efforts of her teammate and so many others. Do you think, you know, I ask this question, not just women's basketball, but I think athletes in totality, that there is appreciation. I think in anything that you do, you have to respect what happened before you in order to build upon it. And is that something that you do? Is that something that you try to instill that, you know, the past is part of the present?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the number one thing, is that we talk about being grateful all the time for those that came before you and wore the uniform before you, because they paid a lot of prices along the way. And I can guarantee you that there wasn't 10,000, 15,000 people in the stands. There wasn't TV contracts. There wasn't, you know, any of that. So one of the things that we've done is we do little things called leadership academies, where we invite women in the community and talk to our team. And some of those have been passed along. And to hear the stories of them getting in station wagons and driving themselves to games, I'm just baffled, you know, where we're driving up on tarmacs and getting in charter planes. I mean, it puts it in perspective when you think, you know, that was 30, 40 years ago. It's not that long ago. It was in my lifetime. So
now, when I was a basketball manager, we went in vans. So that's not
okay,
that.
Okay. I gotcha. But it is. I think it's really important that these kids understand, you know, the price that people paid, especially on the women's side. You know, we're pretty young in the process of, you know, really branding ourselves and getting our own identity. And it's getting to a place that, you know, is you know, getting close to that ceiling, you know, that we've always wanted to get to. Kind of be careful what you wish for. But now make sure you always take them back to let them know, you know, who came before them and the prices that were paid for them to have what they have.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to MSU's president, Luanna Simon, and athletic director, Mark Hollis, talking with MSU women's basketball coach, Susie Merchant.
You're playing in front of 10,000 people. You've gone Big Ten championship, play in the tournament, go to the NCAA. What do you do to keep grounded, to stay real, stay part of the community?
Just talk to Tom Izzo for a few minutes.
Oh, I said stay grounded.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. He's always on me about getting to that Final Four in a national championship, and he's right. I mean, that's, to me, that's the thing that, you know, I feel is, you know, driving force. Every time I walk into the building, I look to my right, and there's Munn Ice Arena with three national championships, mm-hmm. sorry. You know, and then I come in, and I walk in, I look to my left, and there's two over there. So for me, you know, that's a pretty driving force. I grew up with two brothers, so anything boys can do, girls can do just as well. Right. So I have some work to do, no question.
As I've sort of talked to presidents around the country, the relationship the two of you have is somewhat unusual between men's, women's programs, high-profile programs, the sort of success you received. Is that your sense of, as well, that this sort of family atmosphere is unusual here among the men's and women's program?
I think so, because there's always, you know, that innate competitiveness, and, you know, I think your drive to be the best, and you're in the same sport. It's natural, I think. You're in the same building. But, you know, a lot of that credit goes to Tom, because he doesn't operate that way. And I think, you know, it goes back to my earlier statement of, you know, Division II people in a big-time BCS BCS university. And, you know, I've witnessed him talk for 45 minutes to an hour to our women's golf recruit just as much as he would talk to my recruit and sometimes his own. I remember Mark Montgomery said to me, "Hey, Merchant, go over there and get your recruit out of that office, because he's talking to her longer than he's talking to his own."
Yeah.
So I just think it's the atmosphere of that, which is pretty special.
Yeah. So let me shift gears. And there are a number of people listening who have small children. Who are thinking about their capacity to play basketball or some other sport. What, and you're a mom with a couple of small kids, one of whom likes to pound a hockey puck.
Yes, so yes, he does. So
what advice do you have from them, from a parent's perspective with young kids, and how you would want them to develop in sport?
You know, I think now, I think kids are doing too much too soon. That's my opinion. Just being around it so much, I think, you know, when you start over-scheduling kids when they're 6, 7, 8 years old, I think the burnout happens. I really want my kids to be kids and be for a kid as long as they can until they get to the point where they're going to take another step and become, you know, that vision of an elite athlete if they choose that route. So, you know, to answer your question, I think, you know, don't overschedule. Let them play in the summers and go to the pool and kind of develop their own identities. I read an article actually once that said sometimes the organization of sports, all the AAU, the summer youth soccer, some of the T-ball, baseball, that becomes almost a life of its own. And the article talked about how it's hard to build leaders in the young kids now, because when they go to these things, the teams are already picked. They know what uniforms they're supposed to wear, what field they're, and all the adults set everything up. The rules are there. The coaches tell them what to do. You know, I kind of grew up where all the kids were out in the neighborhood, and, you know, you had Ghost Man on first if you didn't have one, and you had to pick your own teams and figure out how to put kids in positions to be successful that maybe weren't as good as the other person. So, you know, to me, I think the overscheduling and just let them be kids.
I think particularly for a generation of women who had to organize those games oftentimes around guys.
That's true.
Where there were strong, you know, sort of inherent societal gender biases, the capacity to sort of fit in at the same time, be recognized for your skill level, and be able to orchestrate some of those decisions on the court, on the field, were really great leadership opportunities to develop a perspective without it costing you anything.
I agree with that. I think you're looking at a unity opportunity where they can lead at the same time that they bring people together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can remember growing up and nobody wanted to pick the girl because I was usually the only one. And then, you know, they didn't want to pick you because they didn't think you could play. And then when they figured out you could play, nobody wanted to guard you, you know, because they didn't want you to make them look bad. So you're right. I mean, the leadership side of playing both sides is interesting.
You got a new coach on campus now that I know you've spent some time with in hockey, Tom Manassas. He's going to be joining us for this show as well. And any comments on the evolution, since you're not the rookie, you're
thankfully
one of the veterans now.
But, yes.
You know, any comments on conversations that you've had with Coach Anastas?
high energy. He's going to get it done, no question about it. I think his passion, his understanding, I think the one thing that strikes me so, you know, so vividly about him is his presence. Whether it's in the community, I've seen him working with coaches. You know, I can only imagine with his team. I mean, he has a vision for where they want to go, and he knows how to bring people together. And he's a great communicator, and he's just a recipe for success. He's going to be a fantastic Michigan State hockey coach.
You know, if you wanted to close some things up, what are some of your perspectives beyond basketball that really have impacted you since coming to Michigan State? Any broad-based issues that you want to promote, that you want to talk about, that are important to you?
Well, I think Dr. Simon talked a little bit about it, is that leadership piece within women. I think not only embracing those in your past, but certainly, you know, helping guide and, you know, make the future leaders of tomorrow. I think these young women have a lot on their plate and they're very successful, and to nurture that, to help them grow so that when they leave here, they're strong, confident women that are educated, that can go take on the world. And to me, that's something that I'm pretty passionate about. I love, you know, reading and meeting different people and setting up opportunities to become a better leader myself and hopefully share some of that with our team.
People often think that when the season's over, the work's over.
Yes. We have our summers off.
Whatever. There's an impression, you know, that there's this easy time of being a coach. So would you think about and help share with people sort of what happens, you know, sort of in that period between when the season ends and when you begin to start up again in the fall with a new group of kids and new sets of expectations about wherever the Final Four is? It doesn't matter because there's an expectation about being
right,
there.
Right, that's right. the number one thing is always, first and foremost, is recruiting. And we come right out of the season and we're in a recruiting period in April through March and into April. And then July is we're gone basically the entire month of July. And then within that, for me, I really like to give back to the community during that time. So as many speaking engagements and opportunities that I can, I try to do that because it's a little harder during the season to get out. So if you can kind of tailor your time a little bit to some May, June opportunities for that. And then we have summer camp. Summer camp is a big part of the culture here at Michigan State and something that we enjoy to do. And that comes up at the end of June. And then before you know it, you come off the road, you do some unofficial visits. It's mid-August and you're getting ready to ramp up again.
Appreciate you being here. I think this is some great dialogue. It continues to keep people thinking. Our coaches are great leaders. I think they have great concepts, and very much appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Bye.
That was MSU women's basketball coach Susie Merchant talking with Spartans athletic director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University president Luana K. Simon on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes on the road in Dallas, Texas to visit with a Flint native and MSU alumnus Tim Whaley at his Glass Recycled here in Dallas. Tim, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here. It's always an honor to be able to talk about where and what we do and where we came from. So glad to be here.
Tell us, what is Glass Recycled?
Glass Recycled is all about taking product, like particularly glass or porcelain, that is landfill bound, and recovering in that from its source, from going to the landfill, and then recreating that into hard surface materials or landscape applications, and just reutilizing what we throw away every day in glass.
And how did you even get started in a company like this?
It was actually reading an article back July 31st, 2002, and I remember reading it. And it was a challenge to the city of Plano of trying to find markets for the use of secondary glass. And at that time, I was doing some studies in marketing for a company in the terrazzo flooring industry, and I thought the idea of using glass in lieu of using marble would be a good application. I didn't see any reason why it wouldn't, but I thought it would be an excellent opportunity to utilize that waste glass.
And you've actually got some projects at your alma mater that people may have walked on. Can you tell me what some of your Michigan State University products are?
That has been a really cool development and advancement for the company. We've been fortunate by design to be in the stadium, new design where the where you go up in the elevator up into the new design boxes. And also we are in the MSU basketball men's locker room. Also the new chemistry building on the floor. And then also we participated in the new recycling center on campus, state-of-the-art design, and we created a conference table. So we've kind of been fortunate to participate in kind of a wide variety of different glass recycled applications.
And Tim Whaley, who are your customers, or who would you like to see go to glassrecycled.com and maybe order something from you?
That's the fun part. I mean, we did not want to limit our applications for just a particular segment or market. By design, we see a lot of architects. We see a lot of interior designers, but we also see homeowners. We've been fortunate to be on shows. You may have seen or heard our product or company on the DIY network. We've been on several of the other home design networks, HDTV. We've been on the ABC America Extreme Makeover. So we've allowed ourselves to be available on our website. You can order product right there. You can order samples from our website. And it's easy to use, and we want you to explore it.
And what are some of the features and benefits of your product over, say, marble, which I guess you're compared to?
The key is one, we're using resources that we know are making an impact in our environment. We also know that the use of glass is excellent by design, and you know it shelters us in many facets in our life. But once it's broken, we think we have no use for it. But by design, it's inert. It's also has no porosity. So you're not going to absorb stains, and hardness factors is not an issue. And, you know, I just think the color, the depth of the variety that you get with it is just by far superior to traditional marble or rock or gravel, as we call it today.
Tim, thanks for telling us about glass recycled on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Tim Whaley is the founder and CEO of Glass Recycled, and you can find out a lot more about his company at glassrecycled.com.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
And for more MSU Today, visit us on the web at msutoday.com.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.